I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Felina Rakowski-Gallagher, founder of The Upper Breast Side, a boutique in Manhattan that sells all products pertaining to breastfeeding. Felina is a former New York City cop who started her business in 1999 after she experienced her own challenges of breastfeeding. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
I was wondering, did you ever expect to have such a career change from cop to breastfeeding store owner?
There's no way. No, there's just no way to even think that that's where it was all leading. This breastfeeding idea just really came literally like a light bulb.
How many children do you have?
I have two kids. Samantha was born in 98, and pretty much right after that birth, that's when the process originated.
What gave you the idea for starting a store helping nursing moms?
It probably came from, of course, having a considerably rough time at it from the time that she was born. But I'd have to say that the moment where I really gasped and just couldn't believe that there was an idea immediately forming was at a support group meeting with a lactation consultant and a number of women attending up at West 100th Street and West End Avenue. It's run by Bev Solo, a wonderful lactation consultant. And in the meeting, there was a woman by the name of Leslie who originated from Salt Lake City. And at the meeting where we were discussing breast pumps, she mentioned that she had returned to visit her family and had gone to the lactation station in Salt Lake City, where a husband and wife team have operated probably the longest standing breastfeeding boutique of its kind in the United States. In this boutique, she was shown and actually was able to test drive a breast pump. And at that point, I just said, "You did what? You took a test drive? They showed you how to use it? You could understand what was going on and actually know if you were using it the right way when you went home? Could you just repeat that?"
And had you not come up with this idea, would you have gone back to your job of being a policewoman and that would have been that?
I truly believe that if I hadn't have thought of this idea, I think that I would have returned full time. As it is, I did return very briefly and then retired soon after. But my husband was a sergeant, I was a cop, and we literally were doing the transfer the child at the exit kind of between shifts. So I had my maternity leave time frame to really figure out if I could make this work.
So what were the first steps that you took to actually make this happen?
Well, let's see. I was a stay-at-home mom with a newborn. So while I was figuring out how to make this little person really happy, I just took little bites of detective work, really. I actually used a lot of the skills that I learned in the police department. And just took little bites of it because, as my dad told me, you can eat an elephant if you do it one bite at a time. Gathering information, going online, doing the research, making phone calls, going to visit any stores that I thought may have already come up with my idea to see if they were on target or not. And then, lo and behold, taking that first big jump.
The name of your store, The Upper Breast Side, is very catchy. I'm wondering if you came up with the title and that excited you or catalyzed you to actually make this happen, or you had this idea and, oh, by the way, what should we name it? We came up with it.
No, the name of it was the result of my girlfriend, Allison, who was really getting fed up with my routinely boring updates on all the new and exciting information I was coming up with. So when you're talking to your friends and they keep hearing the same idea about a project that you're working on, they start to come out with some snarky responses. And hers was, as she called one day, "Hey, how's the upper breast side?" And I said, "What did you say?" I did pass the idea around to people that I considered really good friends with good, you know, heads on their shoulders, because maybe sometimes my ideas are, I'm told, a little far-fetched. And the majority of people thought that it was an inappropriate title. I did not listen.
Furthermore, "You bring your breasts, we've got the rest" is sort of the subtitle of The Upper Breast Side.
That really comes from repeatedly answering the phone with people on the other end asking, what do you do over there? What is it that you do? And depending on my mood, when I've been asked that a few times, you know, by the afternoon, I think that the point is, you bring your breast, we've got the rest, really is should describe it all.
You're very much kind of a matter-of-fact type of woman, and you're not necessarily sort of the warm and nurturing type of personality that people might expect as the owner of such a store. That's... So there is kind of this dissonance between kind of the humor of these titles and your kind of vibe.
Completely accurate. I am. We have the good cop, bad cop role in, at the upper breast side. My mom, who is a patient employee of mine, is the good cop, and I'm the look me in the eyeballs, stop crying, and just tell me what is going on so I can help you fix it. But there are women who completely understandably come in needing a hug, a deep breath, lots of chocolate, something cool to drink. We provide that, but I'm not the person that you're necessarily going to get that anticipated fuzzy, warm package.
It is ironic, especially because a lot of these women come in and they are at the height of their vulnerability, never having been a mom before, sleep deprived, having plumbing issues with their breasts, clogged duct, bleeding nipples, mastitis, which is a painful infection. And here you are, this New York City strong cop, you know, just giving them a lot of tough love.
Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I'm here to try to do my best to tell you about products to save you money, but also to tell you about products that I think are going to fix whatever it is that you came in describing. I'd rather that they actually take less and leave and hope that they remember that I wasn't trying to push them into larger purchases.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Felina Rakowski-Gallagher, founder of The Upper Breast Side, a boutique in Manhattan that sells all products pertaining to breastfeeding. You mentioned your mom works with you.
Yes.
How did that come about?
Well, she is a shopping guru. I was tortured as a child going to Lohmann's with her, and that may be why I really hate shopping. But she loves shopping. She gets excited about being able to show you how to put this and this together and look at this color that goes great with your tone. And again, she softens the edge that we have up at the front if you need it.
What did she do prior to working with you at the Upper Breast Side?
Mom grew up, or I should say mom was primarily a stay-at-home mom. And then as we got older, she helped my dad in a wholesale business in Midtown. When he passed away, I knew that the thing that would really brighten her day is to take a long train ride into the city, put up with my crap at the store, and then go back and start all over again the next day.
Is your husband, by the way, still a cop?
No, Steve retired shortly after I did. He has 20 years on the force, and he currently is in real estate.
When did you end up on the Upper West Side? Were you living there prior to starting the Upper Breast Side?
We were living a block away from where the current location is. The business started in my apartment by appointment only, and I carried the strollers up the stairs myself.
So you knew you wanted to get this business off the ground, and rather than rent a separate place, you used your apartment as the store. Talk to me a little bit about that.
I thought I was doing taking the appropriate steps by going to the Small Business Administration and contacting different business schools, all because I was told that I really needed to have a business plan. No one, and I do mean no one, really stepped up to the plate and gave me the help that I thought I needed to start this business. And somehow I discovered a woman who was going to Columbia Business School. Her name is Rebecca York. And she understood, as a new mom, student, and business major. She sat me down at a couple of Starbucks all over town and a couple of sessions of writing on napkins and drinking way too much coffee. She gave me the business plan that I needed to start slowly without having to put a lot of the capital into the overhead that businesses typically have to start up with.
Mm-hmm.
So I focused on the products and services and started small by having it in my apartment by appointment only.
How did the word spread?
The word spread because of some products that people were looking for, and those products had links to me as a person that had the supplies. From the moment that I opened, it just didn't stop. The phone did not stop ringing.
Well, it's certainly a need that really went unmet for so long. I mean, as a nursing mother myself, you realize just how unprepared you are for those, you know, sleepless nights and the physical rigor in the early days of breastfeeding and the plumbing issues pertaining to the breastfeeding. You know, as I mentioned, the mastitis or the clogged ducts or the sore nipples. And it's ironic to me how breastfeeding is so ubiquitous, yet it's still so kind of on the margin. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, perhaps this would be a good time to bring up coverage just last night of a woman nursing in a store near Bryant Park. And the manager was alerted by a male customer that the woman's breast was being exposed, and he didn't like that and apparently was also stimulated by it in some way. And the manager approached the two moms, one that was nursing, and said, "Ma'am, you'll have to do that somewhere else or cover up." She said, "No, I'm not doing anything wrong." And then the manager told her that she had to leave. Now, New York State law is completely written up to reserve the rights for women. As I tell my ladies that come into the upper breast side, "Ma'am, you can whip your breast out, pause, put the baby on it, and assume any position that you want for the purposes of nursing your child. And no one near you has the right to say anything, including, would you be more comfortable over here?" To which you can either respond politely, "No, thank you," or something unladylike, which I would prefer. And my suggestion pretty much is call 911 or, you know, read this article that I give out titled Why God Invented Necks. But reserve these rights because we are simply feeding our kids in public.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Felina Rakowski-Gallagher, founder of The Upper Breast Side, a boutique in Manhattan that sells all products pertaining to breastfeeding. We'll hear more from Felina coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Felina Rakowski-Gallagher, founder of The Upper Breast Side, a boutique in Manhattan that sells all products pertaining to breastfeeding. Felina is a former New York City cop who started her business in 1999 after she experienced her own challenges of breastfeeding.
We, by the way, also try to promote this information about nursing wherever you and your breasts and your child are by having a dollar bill placed in a bin anytime that someone comes into my place and asks for a cover. Baby Olay, Hooter Hiders, Titty Tents, private dining shawls. These are all things that people look to purchase to cover themselves up with. And out of principle, I refuse to sell them, even though there's a daily request for them. And I explain, I won't sell a product made for the express use of covering up because you're not doing anything wrong.
And by your breastfeeding in public and not covering yourself up, you're actually doing a service to other moms.
It's learned behavior. We can't get it all from a movie or a book. And until you're holding that child in your arms, it's really hard to figure out what's going on. It's like going to driver's ed. You see the movie, you're in the back seat, but until you're behind the driver's seat, it's really, really hard.
Did your mom breastfeed you?
She did not. In Europe, she was told that she didn't make enough milk. To which at this point now she, by being in my place all day long, understands that I probably wasn't nursing sufficiently. And then the doctor just didn't give very much support or help and said, "Well, you're not making enough milk." But if she had a breast pump at that point and a great lactation consultant, some of these pieces could have fit together.
So you do sell a lot of breast pumps in your shop. How old are breast pumps?
Breast pumps. Well, let's see. When was the bicycle horn invented? I can tell you that Medela The Swiss company has been around for at least 20 years or mm-hmm. more, and they're one of the largest breast companies. But we do have a little artifact in the store, which is an old pump, manual pump, and it looks like a bicycle horn.
I want to go back to the early days. What were some of the challenges you faced in getting the store off the ground?
My husband would call at about 5 o'clock and say, "Hi, honey, I'm downstairs. Is it okay for me to come up?" And there were enough times when I'd say, "Honey, could you just do the flight pattern outside for a while?"
Walk around the block?
Yes, like a plane trying to land. He would just do roaming around outside, sit on the stoop, look at his watch. And I knew this because I could see him from downstairs. So the living room was filled with women pretty much, undressed from the waist up, either because they were trying bras or clothing or being shown how to use breast pumps. And then finally he'd get home and look at me, look at the kitchen where there was no activity. And I knew he was wondering, where the heck is my dinner? Mm-hmm. So that was the time that Steve learned how to cook.
Mm-hmm.
But it got really stressful towards the end because our home no longer felt like our home.
How many men come into the store? Are there more men or fewer men than you expected?
25% of the people that walk in are men. They are immediately warned about passing the curtain unless they're blind or blindfolded. That is said with a police tone, by the way, like in the same way that give me your license, and registration. And so they'll look back at me, and then I soften it a little bit by handing them the TV clicker, pointing to the chocolate, and inviting them to have a glass of refreshing water
while their wives try on nursing bras.
Precisely.
The reason I ask is I think breastfeeding is more of a family issue than I personally realized. Just the notion that you're the one who has to wake up in the middle of the night and feed your kid, and your husband should be supportive of just what you're taking on. And in a way, it's nice to see men being helpful and coming to the store and buying products or just even coming with their wives.
That's an interesting point, because if they do accompany their partner to the store, they see other mothers with their partners and realize that there's a whole population out there. And then they start, kind of digesting all that. I'm told that my husband actually asked me when I was going to stop nursing Samantha when she was just a few months old. And I'm told, because I don't remember the exact incident, that my response was such that he never asked again. It is really important for other partners of mom's nursing to speak to other people and find out that the reason that a mom may or may not be able to spell her name in the morning is, this is the key. Here's the secret, everybody. She's in charge of input and you're in charge of output. So when I hear that partners are sleeping through the night, they do get a lot of abuse from me if I can dish it out in a timely fashion. They should be the ones that are doing the diaper changes and the burping, because that scenario in itself could be at least an hour, depending on what kind of rookie you are with those two activities. In the meantime, mom's already closed her eyes and gotten rapid REM.
Mm-hmm.
And before you know it, it's time to do it all over again. If she's doing it all, she can't spell her name in the morning.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Felina Rakowski-Gallagher, founder of The Upper Breast Side, a business that sells all products pertaining to breastfeeding, located on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Her logo is "You Bring Your Breasts, and We've Got the Rest." What are some of the surprises of, running a store like this? You're somebody who, is a former cop, very matter of fact. Like, did you expect that there would be such a large psychological component to the work that you do?
Mentally, it's exhausting, because it's not the typical walk in, find your product, pay for it, and leave. Our questions are not typically, let us know if you need any help, but hey, what do you do? What's going on? How's the pregnancy? My feet look just as big as yours did back in the eighth month kind of stuff. Other surprises in the store? Are you really asking me this question? Do you really think I can see through the telephone and tell you what size breasts you have right now?
You mean a mother will call you up and say, what size bra do I need? And without your seeing her breasts?
Yeah, well, yeah. And then I've been known to say, just hold your breasts closer to the telephone and I'll tell you. These are women who are not getting enough sleep. And I've said that to people. Mm-hmm. Ma'am, you really need more sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do have a reputation because usually when you call places, you're not being told that you need more sleep with that question.
And by the way, we talk about the challenges that your customers are facing and, you know, you've had your own set of challenges. I don't know if you feel comfortable talking about it, but if you're willing, I think it would be helpful just to hear some of the issues that you were facing while you were also, by the way, running this very intense business.
Right. Well, God has a sense of humor. But, you know, here I am selling bras and I have one breast. And the reason I have one breast and I sell bras with one breast is because a year after Jack was born.
Your second child.
Correct. I finally got my two breasts over to a breast surgeon because the one side just never seemed to work. And I also am in touch with many people in the breast business who are the specialists, the go-to people, the lactation consultants, the physicians, and none of them came up with what was wrong. So I was treated for infections before he was born, and then all through the beginning of the nursing to the point where, sadly, I just nursed him on one side. So I went on for nursing him for a year with just one breast. And then went to a breast surgeon. And fast forward, the DCIS, ductal carcinoma in situ, that they thought I had, stage zero, post-mastectomy was stage three. And then there was the chemo and the radiation.
Breast cancer.
Correct. Breast cancer. Two lumps that the OBGYN failed to take note of in such a way that would have brought me to a surgeon earlier. Just a note on that is that she kept deferring my non-functioning breast and saying that I was the breast expert. So sadly, I did lose my left side, but I still have my right one. And I have a chicken breast insert, which is probably more than you need to know right now, but you know, I try to maintain a pretty rough sense of humor about it. I'm still here around. My kids still have a mother and my husband still has a wife. And, you know, I try to be very attentive to moments when women themselves are coming in and just throwing out there very quietly the fact that they think there might be something going on. And I just go right to 100.
In case it might be breast cancer.
By the way, the human milk bank, I personally became aware of when I needed the radioactive dye when I was diagnosed. And I knew that Jack, who had never had any formula, was going to need breast milk that I had none in supply of.
Mm.
I decided at the last minute not to buy that milk because a friend of mine had just had a baby and actually gave me freshly pumped breast milk to feed him until the time frame of the radioactive dye was out of my body.
So you really went to, you know, extremes to
ensure. You know, the cancer took so much away from me. I was going to be damned if it was going to be the reason to start.
Mm-hmm. So you were going through this personally while you were still operating the store?
Oh, yeah. Yes. And there are stories about that, too. Some of them are about how scary looking I was with no hair, no eyebrows, no eyelashes. You get the picture? And trying to be sympathetic to someone who had a rough night's sleep and blah, blah, blah. I mean, I think I maintained, you know, the sympathy of that. It's just that when, oh, please, could you just stay open a little bit later? Because, you know, I came all the way from, you know, and I'm anticipating, you know, Hong Kong or something. And they're like, the east side. I came all the way from the east side and, you know, you have these weird hours. Could you just stay open a little bit longer? And one time I said to this one mom, well, sure, let me just call and cancel my chemo appointment. And she just paused and looked right at me and said, that'd be great. And I said, listen, you know, I would have never even thought that you'd go down that road. So we're going to have to say no, thank you. But that's where some of the customers take me. You know, it's the sun revolves around them. And I try to say gently, listen, you know, I have this business, but I'm also a mom and a wife. Mm-hmm. So cut me some slack, cut my employees some slack because they've been on their feet all day. Mm-hmm. And we're doing the best that we can. And bras are not usually an emergency. So we try.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Felina Rakowski Gallagher, founder of The Upper Breast Side, a business that sells all products pertaining to breastfeeding, located on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Her logo is You Bring Your Breasts, and We've Got the Rest. What are plans for expansion, if any? What are your current thoughts about that?
Expansion. Expansion involves the ability to clone myself. I am a pretty bad micromanager. So actually, some of it is just finding that perfect clone of myself. So if you're listening out there, I'm looking for you. Mm-hmm. And but I definitely think that a place with the philosophy that we have should be available within certain radiuses all over the country. That's not to say that I want to open up all over the country, but I do think that we could set ourselves down in some places where really moms have nothing, and help raise the consciousness of, you know, how to go about and just feed your child.
You talk about going to places where the knowledge of breastfeeding is, you know, uncovered to some extent. Talk to me a little bit about just, you know, getting breastfeeding into more of the right. Public consciousness.
Well, when you think of how often even children's books portray a mom, a baby, and a baby bottle, how often do you see a mom nursing a baby in a child's book that you're reading to your child? So let's start from really the early on process. I have a small collection of books pertaining to for kids to read that have images of nursing. Why? Because if they see it in a book, then again, they think that's exactly what should be done. In much of the same way that Samantha has had playdates in inside the Upper Breast Side. I hope that at some point in years down the road that one of her friends comes to me and says, I had a playdate with Samantha and there were all these women just whipping their breast out and nursing everywhere. And people told me when I was about to have a baby that, oh, I shouldn't, I couldn't, whatever. And I kept remembering how easy it was for all those ladies at the Upper Breast Side. So I did. And here I am a nursing mom because I had a playdate at the Upper Breast Side.
You know, with all that you've been through, just with the chemotherapy and running a store about breastfeeding and breastfeeding your own children, what do you think your son or daughter's attitude is towards breastfeeding? Or is it too? Or are they too young to tell?
Well, my little guy spends time in the bra room. He's labeled as the only cowboy allowed in the back room. He's been known to just get up, walk over to one of the bras and pick something off and bring the hanger over to a customer and say, you know, hey, this looks really nice, just because he knows that it gets a giggle out of the ladies. So he's in a room filled with women who are not looking embarrassed at all. And I think he's getting a very healthy perspective of women's bodies and when they have a big tummy or when they don't have a big tummy. Lots of breasts all over the place. And I think he's going to grow up to be the kind of dude that we'd like to see a little bit more of down the road.
He's five.
He's five. Mm. Turning six soon.
Incidentally, you were a New York City cop formerly before starting the Upper Breast Side. How supportive is the NYPD of new moms?
At the end of my career, I was working for the chief of personnel at headquarters, and I already inundated the staff there with my ideas and, of course, came to visit, bringing my breast and my child along with me. So there were some screaming men running out of rooms at that time, including the chief. I think he did that to be funny. But what I did find is that the upper breast side and people who had heard about it, it did lend itself to a few moms who decided to really present nursing in the workforce as something that just simply has to be done. Now, one sergeant in particular was able to pump with greater frequency and longevity because she was not wearing a bulletproof vest all day long. So NYPD and other police departments all over the country have a challenge because they're hiring women in childbearing years and then not supporting them fully when they deliver. I do believe that especially the NYPD could be on the forefront of leading police departments all over the country by just having a great pump in every precinct. That's actually one of my little projects that I'm trying to get out there, is that show the women who you hired in childbearing years that, yes, they can come back to the job but continue to be a nursing mom. How do you do that? You give them the right equipment. And what do you get in return? Priceless, priceless support from the moms who understand that you're a business that understands the people that it hires.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so very much.
My guest has been Felina Rakowski-Gallagher, founder of The Upper Breast Side, a boutique in Manhattan that sells all products pertaining to breastfeeding.
Coming up, we'll meet Charlie Clifford, founder of Tumi, a leading luggage and travel accessories company. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Charlie Clifford, founder of Tumi, a leading travel accessories company. Tumi has been making high-end, durable travel bags since 1975, and the company has over 50 retail stores worldwide, with locations in Tokyo, London, New York, Paris, and Chicago. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Very nice to be with you this afternoon.
Where does the name Tumi come from?
I was actually in the Peace Corps with my wife from 1967 through 69, and we lived in Peru, worked in Peru, and the Tumi was a god figure, an icon-like symbol of the department, which is the equivalent of a state where we were living at the time. We named a dog in Peru Tumi, and we came back from Peru and named another dog Tumi, and when we were setting up the company in 1975, I had signed up for a trade show, and I didn't expect to get in when the director of the show said, well, we have a place we can give you, which I was very surprising news. He said, by the way, what's your company called? And I tried to act very nonchalant and said, well, actually, we're just in formation now. We're choosing among several names. Let me give you a call tomorrow, and rushed home and talked with my wife. And we agreed that the Tumi had a lot of meaning for us, so it was a sentimental choice, and it stuck for a long time.
Now, how do you go from the Peace Corps to starting a major business? What happens in between those two?
After graduating with a degree in literature, I realized that I wasn't going to be a professor, wasn't going to be the world's next greatest writer, so decided to really focus on something that would allow me to earn a living.
And why travel bags?
Everything is a little bit serendipitous in life, I think, a question of timing and many other things. When I came back, after spending that time in the Peace Corps, I worked for the Grand Union Company in retailing and then joined a company run by a friend of a friend, which was a small importing company doing really probably dozens of handcrafted products from half the countries, or at least it seemed like it was half the countries in South America, ranging from wall hangings to rugs to hand-carved gourds to leather goods, happened to be one of the product categories. And my friend was unable to did not want to focus on leather goods. So after some discussions with him, I decided to leave the company and to take leather goods as a product category that we could focus on and develop a business.
Where did you initially source your bags?
Well, this company was sourcing from Colombia. And we ended up going to Colombia and working with suppliers there who served us very well for many years.
What was the political situation like in Colombia, and did that affect at all the quality or the consistency of the bags you were getting?
Well, it didn't really. We were always a little apprehensive about our shipments getting through customs because even at that time in the late 70s and early 80s, Colombia was notorious for the drugs that were coming into the States. So we were always a little nervous and hoping that nobody had slipped anything into the containers. But we really didn't have any direct political effects.
How did you raise capital initially?
Well, we didn't have a lot of capital, Jessica. We started with an investment of $10,000, if I remember correctly. And my half of that consisted of some leather tennis bags that I had accumulated from the company that I had been working for previously. They weren't able to pay me some money they owed me. Times were a little bit difficult, so they paid me in tennis bags, and at least I was able to convert them into some capital for the new business.
And what state were you living in at the time?
We were living in New Jersey.
So you were importing these bags from Colombia, and who were you selling them to?
Our initial customers were byproducts of the wonderful 60s, the age of Aquarius. There were a lot of people running leather stores where they might be making sandals and belts in the back and possibly putting some bags together. But we had a product grouping that was a very rustic, natural leather, very rugged leather. So we fit in very well to this environment. But the specialty stores and the leather goods luggage area were the ones who really were responsible for helping to establish the brand. I think our first year of sales were $630,000.
Now, you had a shift in design from the 1970s to the 1980s. What was that shift in design?
It all started to, I mean, one of the key points, critical points in the company was the period, which I think was 82, 83, when we had this awful stagflation in the country. The interest rates for a company like ours were in the 20% area. There was a serious recession on, so our sales started to decline. And we really had to look in the mirror, look inwards, and say, what are we going to be when we grow up? We lost money for a couple of years. We had the bone-chilling experience, if you will, of having lunch with our bankers and coming back to the office and telling them that we had suffered a loss for the quarter. And the bankers all of a sudden looked very grave and very serious, and the meeting ended fairly quickly, and we had a call as soon as they got back to their office in Philadelphia suggesting they thought it would be a good idea if we came down to Philadelphia for a chat the following Monday. And when my partner and I arrived in Philadelphia and we went to the floor we'd been told to visit and found the office, we saw a sign over it saying Asset Recovery Department, and we realized that we were in a little bit of a difficult situation. We had to cut expenses and tighten our belts. And we happened to have a terrific homegrown designer by the name of Jeff Bertelsen. And he really deserves full credit for coming up with the designs that put us on the map. He isolated himself, worked in a little cubicle, probably smaller than 8x10, and drew and sketched and had some samples made and came up with these highly functional products which reflect the way people packed.
And what do those products look like for those who don't have the luxury of having a Tumi bag?
Well, the whole key to our core design concept was using U-shaped pockets. And the U-shaped pockets allowed people to pack easily, to open the pockets, the flap would come down, and they could put folded shirts or a toiletry kit or shoes or rolled-up sweaters or any one of a number of items in those pockets.
My husband has a Tumi bag, and he loves the fact that if you unzip the middle part, it opens up this vast space. It doesn't look apparent from looking at it. It looks like a compact bag, but really there's a lot of secret space or storage in there.
Well, before we developed this particular look, most of the luggage pieces on the market were semi-structured, and the category of products known as business cases really consisted of hard attachés. And they were very sturdy and very workmanlike, but not particularly user-friendly. We took this U-shape zipper concept that we employed in our garment bags, and thanks to Jeff's efforts, we really carried this look over into business cases. And one of the great features that we put into it, which Jeff added, was a expandable section. And for many of the pieces, that would increase the capacity by up to 50%.
Were they adopted immediately, or did it take some time for the public to get used to this new fashion?
It definitely took a few years, but it wasn't until about our third trade show that I realized we had really hit upon something, because many of the owners and the buyers from this highly influential specialty store network were visiting our stand at the show, and they were carrying Tumi bags. When it moved from advertising people and architects and other creative types and to the buyers and then to the financial industry, where many of the investment bankers that we did business with in later years were using Tumi products, then we realized that we had this walking advertisement that was out there every day.
So it seems that actually negative circumstances helped you. The fact that there was stagflation and the economy was in the doldrums, and the fact that bankers were on your back, really caused you to be lean and creative about your designs. At one point, you bought out your partner because you had different views on the business. You wanted to hire talent and grow more aggressively, and he was more conservative when it came to hiring and growing the business. How did you go about that process?
I really didn't have any cash at all. I realized that finally that I would have to go to my father-in-law, George Beale, for a loan. And I didn't want to do that because he had been interested in the business and he was a very successful manufacturer's rep in the packaging industry and invested in a little packaging company and done well. But I was quite proud of being independent and finding my own way. And I think he was kind of bemused at his son-in-law peddling bags around the country. Well, having determined I was going to buy my partner out, I sought him out and so told him what the story was. And he said he would be happy to take a look at it and try to help me out. And I can recall sitting down with him and pulling out a balance sheet. And he mused over it for a few minutes and scratched his head and said, gee, the way I look at it, looks to me like you're broke.
Oh.
And I said, well, technically, we've got a negative net worth at this time. We've had a couple of tough years, but I really believe we can turn this thing around and make something of it. And he wasn't quite as sure as I was, but being my father-in-law, he decided to invest with me. And we had a negotiation about the investment, and he wanted to buy all stock, and I wanted it all as a loan. And we finally compromised, and the money he put in was half stock and half loan. And I'm happy to say that he came out very well with his investment. And also, I'm very grateful and appreciative of the fact that his investment allowed me to buy my partner out and for us to embark on what proved to be a very long and fruitful journey.
Did that at all impact your relations with them personally?
Well, his being an investor in the business, I guess, gave us something to talk about whenever I visited. He was always interested in what we were doing and how we were doing it, and I would try to provide him with just enough information to make him comfortable but not get into too much detail. So it was always a little bit of a chess match when we were talking about how the business was doing.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Charlie Clifford, founder of Tumi, a leading travel accessories company that was founded in 1975. What role did your family play in this whole process over the 25-plus years you're with the company? What about your wife?
She was an adult educator, worked in education for many years, and her career was as important to her as mine was to me. But behind the scenes, she was extremely supportive. When we were pinching pennies, we had salespeople and other visitors stay with us on a pretty regular basis. When times got difficult and the bank asked for personal guarantees, as she was right there signing alongside me. And we wouldn't have had any kind of success if she had not been supportive of the business.
How many children do you have?
We have two children.
And what was their interaction with the business?
Our son got involved with the business about 7 or 8 years ago. He didn't come in as the heir apparent. I'm proud to say that he didn't have any special privileges and has accomplished what he's done due to his own merits.
How about your daughter?
She spent about a year and a half, 2 years with the business and left the business after 9/11 because we were cutting back. And I had a very difficult conversation when I said, you know, we're going to be making some cutbacks, Tara. And she said, Dad, are you telling me I'm going to be fired? And I said, well, not now, but we're going to be doing some layoffs at the end of the year. And because you're new to the company, I'm going to have to, you know, you're going to have to be included among the people who will be leaving because it wouldn't be fair to everybody else.
I want to switch to distribution. You do have over 50 retail stores around the world, yet you also depended on department stores like Bloomingdale's and Neiman Marcus in the early days. How did you think about selling the product or distributing the product?
One of our retailers in Santa Monica, California, was expanding into a mall there, and he said, look, I've got more space than I need. Why don't I open a Toomey store alongside mine? So that store was opened, I believe, in 1997. It succeeded really from day one, and we followed that with another probably 7, 8, 10 stores that we opened in partnership with specialty retailers where they operated the store, but we would participate with the design and with the fixturing of the store and show that retailing would be a successful model for the brand. And then following 2001, there was a further consolidation of the industry, and it became apparent to us. One of our major customers at the time was a chain of over 140 stores. That was a byproduct of a merger and acquisition situation. So when the parent company, which was Wilson's Leather, decided to close the specialty stores, which were being operated under the names of Bentley's and El Portal, we lost close to 140 doors in one fell swoop. So that really forced us to take retailing as a serious avenue and to begin developing our own stores.
It seems interesting that you were dabbling in retail, but again, negative circumstances forced you into a business decision, which was to open up more retail stores after 2001.
Right. We probably would have begun opening our own stores, but we would have done it certainly at a much slower pace. That's correct.
How about celebrities using your bag?
Well, there were really dozens and dozens of celebrities who were using our bags, and we were always very discreet about using their names because that's something that's frowned upon. And but people who were traveling frequently, entertainers, athletes, business people, of course, business executives, people from television, radio, singing, people were really on the road all the time. They became our best customers.
It's interesting that you are adamant about being discreet about that, whereas nowadays, you know, you see celebrities carrying around a certain bottled water or a certain handbag, and they are they're all over People magazine and InStyle. And so was there any of that?
Well, those are really paid placements that that is where people are paid to give a soft endorsement to different products to be photographed using them. And we really, certainly in the early days, we really didn't participate in that. Now, in recent years, the company has given away some bags for events like the Grammys and the Oscars. But typically, the company has never looked for celebrities to endorse its products.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Charlie Clifford, founder of Toomey, a leading travel accessories company that was founded in 1975. After September 11th, the travel business took a little dive.
Took a big dive.
So what did you do in response to that?
We had to begin cutting costs very aggressively. We deferred a couple of store openings. Most painfully, we had to let a number of people go.
How many employees did you have at the time?
We had over 500 at the time.
And how many did you have to let go?
25% probably.
Luckily, in 2002, you had a private equity firm, Oak Tree Capital, come in and buy 60% of the company for $35 million. Sometimes when private equity folks come in and venture capitalists come in, they try to not oust management, but replace the head guy with somebody whom they think is better. Did you ever have any of those leadership issues?
I realized at that time that moving to that kind of situation, that it would be appropriate for me to make way, if you will, for somebody with more of a financial background. We did that in 2003 because it was appropriate for the business.
One of the other things you did was move your production from the Americas to Asia.
Following 9/11, we came to the painful conclusion that we would have to move our nylon production to Asia. We had been producing with a couple of brothers in Vidalia, Georgia, about 70 miles from Savannah, David and Alan Rice, who had been terrific partners for almost 20 years, approaching 20 years. And it was very, very difficult to have to go to them and tell them that we're going to be forced to move to Asia. And in this case, we did it because we needed to lower our costs and increase our margins. When we moved our leather production to Asia, it was more to improve the quality.
So the story ends well, because in 2004, Oak Tree and you sold to me to another private equity company for about $275 million. What are you doing in retirement? You've been retired for a few years now.
Well, in 2006, in the spring of 2006, I started to do some consulting with small and medium-sized companies, most of them related to the leather goods industry.
It seems like you can't stop working.
Well, when I started the business, my hair was brown, and I combed over the enough hair on the top of my head to make me feel that I was had hair. Now I've got a white beard and a bald pate, and so perhaps that's due to the wear and tear of the business. But it's been it was almost 30 years of a lot of joy, really.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. No, you're welcome, or thank you. I'm just kidding. My guest has been Charlie.
Deep breath. thank you, Jessica. It's been fun to talk with you.
My guest has been Charlie Clifford, founder of Tumi. To learn more about the show, visit our website at fromscratchradio.org, where you can download a podcast on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, or join us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.